7th. Thank you for that, sir. It beats faulty towers. What the hell is that? It's what they call a comedy over here, Admiral. It's funny if you can understand it. Brief me in next time I come over, the DDI suggested. Aye, aye, sir. Family okay? We're all just fine, sir. Thank you for asking. Okay. Have a good one. See ya.
What was that? Kathy asked in the living room.
The boss. He's sending me something to work on.
What exactly?
She never stopped trying. He didn't say. Just a heads up that I have something new to play with.
And he didn't tell you what it was?
The Admiral likes his surprises.
Huh,
was her response. The courier settled into his first-class seat. The package in his carry-on bag was tucked under the seat in front, and he had a collection of magazines to read. Since he was covert, not an official diplomatic courier, he could pretend to be a real person, a disguise that he'd shed at Heathrow's Terminal 4 immigration desk, there to catch an embassy car for the ride into Grosvenor Square. Mainly, he looked forward to a nice pub and some Brit beer before he flew back home in a day and a half. It was a waste of talent and training for the newly hatched field officer, but everyone had to pay his dues. And this, for a guy fresh out of the farm, was just that. He consoled himself with the thought that whatever it was, it had to be a little bit important. Sure, Wilbur. If it were all that important, he'd be on the Concorde. Ed Foley was sleeping the sleep of the just. The next day he'd find an excuse to head over to the British Embassy and have a sit-down with Nigel and plan the operation. If that went well, he'd wear his reddest tie and take the message from Oleg Ivanich, set up the next face-to-face, and go forward with the operation. Who is it, he wondered, who the KGB is trying to kill? The Pope? Bob Ritter had his knickers in a twist over that. Or somebody else. The KGB had a very direct way of dealing with people it didn't like. CIA did not. They hadn't actually killed anyone since the 50s, when President Eisenhower had used CIA, actually quite skillfully, as an alternative to employing uniformed troops in an overt fashion. But that skill hadn't been conveyed to the Kennedy administration, which had screwed up nearly everything it touched. Too many James Bond books, probably. Everything in fiction was simpler than the real world, even fiction written by a former field spook. In the real world, zipping your zipper could be hard. But he was planning a fairly complex operation and telling himself that it wasn't all that complex. Was he making a mistake? Foley's mind wandered while the rest of his consciousness slept. Even asleep, he kept going over and over things. In his dreams, he saw rabbits running around a green field while foxes and bears watched. The predators didn't move on them, perhaps because they were too fast and/or too close to their rabbit holes for them to waste a chase. But what happened when the rabbits got too far away from their holes? Then the foxes could catch them, and the bears could move in to swallow them whole. And his job was to protect the little bunnies, wasn't it? Even so, in his dream, the foxes and bears just watched while he, the eagle, circled high and looked down. He, the eagle, had sworn off rabbits, though a fox might be a nice morsel to rip apart, if his talons got it properly, just behind the head to snap the neck and leave him for the bear to eat, because bears didn't really care whom they ate. No, Mr. Bear didn't care one little bit. He was just a big old bear, and his belly was always empty. He'd even eat an eagle if he got the chance, but the eagle was too swift and too smart, wasn't he? Only so long as he kept his eyes open, the noble eagle told himself.
He had great abilities and fine sight, but even he had to be careful. And so the eagle soared aloft, riding the thermals and watching. He couldn't enter the fray exactly. At most, he could swoop down and warn the cute little bunnies that there was danger about. But the bunnies were proverbially dumb bunnies, munching their grass and not looking around as much as they ought to. That was his job, the noble eagle told himself, to use his superb eyesight to make sure he knew everything he needed to know. The bunny's job was to run when he needed to run, and with help from the eagle, to run to a different field, one without foxes and bears around it, so that he could be free to raise more cute little bunnies and live happily ever after, like Beatrix Potter's little Flopsy, Mopsy, and Cottontail. Foley rolled over, and the dream ended. The eagle watching for danger, and the rabbits eating their grass, and the foxes and bears a good way off, just watching, but not moving, because they didn't know which bunny would stray too far from its safe little hole. The alarm clock's deliberately annoying buzz caused Foley's eyes to snap open, and he rolled over to switch it off. Then he jerked himself out of bed and into the bathroom. He suddenly missed his house in Virginia. It had more than one bathroom. 2.5, in fact, which allowed some degree of flexibility should an emergency occur. Little Eddie got up when summoned, then almost immediately sat on the floor in front of the TV set and called out, "Worker woman!" when the exercise show came on. That generated a smile from his mom and dad. Even the KGB guys on the other end of the bug wires probably had a little chuckle at that. "Anything important planned for the office today?" Mary Pat asked in the kitchen. "Well, ought to be the usual weekend traffic from Washington. I have to run over to the Brit Embassy before lunch." "Oh, what for?" his wife asked. "I want to stop over and see Nigel Haydock about a couple of things," he told her as she set the bacon frying. Mary Pat always did bacon and eggs on the day of important spook work. He wondered if their KGB listeners would ever tumble to that. Probably not. Nobody was that thorough, and American eating habits probably interested them only insofar as foreigners usually ate better than Russians. "Well, say hello for me." "Right." He yawned and took a sip of coffee. "We need to have them over. Maybe next weekend."
"Works for me.
Roast beef and the usual."
"Yeah, I'll try to get some frozen corn on the cob."
Russians grew corn you could buy in the open farmers' markets, and it was okay, but it wasn't the Silver Queen that they'd come to love in Virginia. So they usually settled for the frozen corn the Air Force flew in from Rhein Main, along with the Chicago Red hot dogs that they served in the embassy canteen, and all the other tastes of home that became so important on a posting like this one. It was probably just as true in Paris, Ed thought. Breakfast went quickly, and half an hour later, he was almost dressed.
"Which tie today, honey?"
"Well, in Russia, you should wear red once in a while," she said, handing the tie over with a wink, along with the lucky silver tie bar.
"Mm-hmm," he agreed, looking in the mirror to snug it into his collar. "Well, here is Edward Foley, Sr., Foreign Service Officer."
"Works for me, honey." She kissed him, a little loudly.
"Bye, Daddy," Junior said as his father headed for the door. A high five instead of a kiss. He'd gotten a little too old for the sissy stuff.
The rest of the trip was stultifyingly routine. Walk to the metro, buy his paper at the kiosk, and catch the exact same train for the same 5 kopeck fare. Because if he caught the same one going home, so as to be marked by KGB as a creature of strict routine, then he had to mirror image morning and afternoon habits. At the embassy, he entered his office and waited for Mike Russell to bring in the morning message traffic. More than usual, he saw at once, flipping through the messages and checking the headers. Anything about what we talked about? The communications officer asked, lingering for a moment.
Doesn't look like it, Foley replied.
Got you a little torqued?
Ed, getting secure stuff in and out is my only job, you know?
Look at it from my side, Mike. If they tumble to me, I'm as useless as tits on a boar hog. Not to mention the guys who get killed because of it.
Yeah, I hear you.
Russell paused.
I just can't believe they can crack my systems, Ed. Like you said, you'd be losing people left and right.
I want to agree with you, but we can't be too careful, can we?
Roger that, man. I catch anybody dicking around in my shop, they won't live long enough to talk to the FBI, he promised darkly.
Don't get too carried away.
Ed, when I was in Vietnam, non-secure signals got soldiers killed. That's as important as things get, you know?
If I hear anything, I'll make sure you know about it, Mike.
Okay. Russell headed out, not quite trailing smoke out of his ears.
Foley organized his message traffic. It was addressed to the chief of station, of course, not to anyone's name, and started reading through it. There was still concern about KGB and the Pope, but aside from the rabbit, he had nothing new to report, and it was only hope that told him the Flopsy had anything to report on that subject. A lot of interest in last week's Politburo meeting, but for that he'd have to wait for his sources to report in. Questions about Leonid Brezhnev's health, but while they knew the names of his physicians, a whole team of them, none of them talked to CIA directly. You could see the picture on TV and know that Leonid Ilyich wasn't going to be running the marathon in the next Olympics. But people like that could linger for years. Good news and bad news. Brezhnev wasn't going to be doing anything new and different, but as he became increasingly irrational, there was no telling what dumbass things he might try. Damn sure he wasn't going to be pulling out of Afghanistan. He didn't care a rap about the lives of young Russian soldiers, not when he heard death's footsteps approaching his own door. The succession was of interest to CIA, but it was fairly settled that Yuri Vladimirovich Andropov would be the next guy at the seat at the head of the table, absent a sudden death or a major foot put wrong in a political sense. Andropov was too canny a political operator for that, however. No, he was the current Tsarevich, and that was that. Hopefully, he wouldn't be too vigorous. And he wouldn't if the stories about his liver disease were true. Every time Foley saw him on Russian TV, he looked for the yellow tinge on his skin that announced that particular ailment. But makeup could hide that, if they used makeup on their political chieftains. How to check that, he wondered. Something to send back to the Science and Technology Directorate at Langley, maybe. Zaitsev took his seat after relieving Kolya Dobrik and looked over his message traffic. He decided to memorize as much as possible, and so he took a little longer than usual forwarding the messages to their end recipients. There was one from Agent Cassius again, routed for political intelligence people upstairs, and also at the U.S.-Canada Institute, where the academicians read the tea leaves for the center as a backup. There was one from Neptune, requesting money for the agent who was giving KGB such good communications intelligence. Neptune suggested the sea, didn't it? Zaitsev searched his memory for previous signals from that source. Wasn't it mainly about the American Navy? And he was the reason he worried about American signals security. Surely KGB was paying him a huge amount of money, hundreds of thousands of dollars in American cash, something KGB had a problem getting a hold of. It was far easier for the Soviet Union to pay in diamonds, since it could mine for diamonds in eastern Siberia. They'd paid some Americans in diamonds, but they'd been caught by the vigilant American FBI, and KGB had never tried to negotiate their release. So much for loyalty. The Americans tried to do that, he knew, but most of the time the people they tried to get out had already been executed. A thought that stopped his thoughts cold in their tracks. But there was no turning back now, and CIA was competent enough that KGB feared it, and didn't that mean that he was in good hands? Then he remembered one other thing he had to do today. In his drawer was a pad of contact reports. Mary had suggested he report their meeting, and so he did. He described her as pretty, in her late 20s or early 30s, mother of a fairly nice little son, and none too bright. Very American in mannerisms, he wrote, with modest language skills, good vocabulary but poor syntax and pronunciation, which made her Russian understandable but stilted. He didn't make an evaluation of her likelihood to be an intelligence officer, which he figured was the smart thing to do. After 15 minutes of writing, he walked it over to the department security officer. This was a waste of time, he said, handing it to the man. A captain passed over for promotion twice. The security officer scanned it. Where did you meet her? It's right there. He pointed to the contact form. I took my Zaychik for a walk in the park, and she showed up with her little boy. His name is Eddie. Actual name is evidently Edward Eduardovich. Edward Junior, as the Americans say it. Age 4, I think she said. A nice little boy. We talked a few minutes about not very much, and the two of them walked away. Your impression of her? If she is a spy, then I am confident of the victory of socialism, Zaitsev replied. She is rather pretty, but far too skinny, and not overly bright. What I suppose is a typical American housewife. Anything else? It's all there, comrade captain. It took longer to write that up than it did to speak with her. Your vigilance is noted, comrade major. I serve the Soviet Union. And Zaitsev headed back to his desk. It was a good idea on her part, he thought, to cross this T so assiduously. There might have been a shadow on her after all, and if not, then there would be a new entry in her KGB file, reported by a KGB officer, certifying that she was no threat to world socialism. Back at his desk, he returned to making extra careful mental notes of his daily work. The more he gave CIA, the better he'd be paid. Maybe he would take his daughter to that Disney Planet amusement park, and maybe his little Zaychik would enjoy herself there. His signals included other countries, too, and he memorized those as well. One codenamed minister in England was interesting. He was probably in their foreign ministry and provided excellent political, diplomatic intelligence that they loved upstairs. Foley took an embassy car for the drive to the British Embassy. They were cordial enough once he showed his ID, and Nigel came down to meet him in the grand foyer, which was, indeed, quite grand. "Hello, Ed." He gave a hearty handshake and a smile. "Come this way." They went up the marble stairs and then right to his office. Haydock closed the door and pointed him to a leather chair. "What can I do for you?" "We got a rabbit," Foley said, skipping the preliminaries. And that said it all. Haydock knew that Foley was a spook, a cousin in the British terminology. "Why are you telling me?" "We're going to need your help getting him out. We want to do that through Budapest, and our station there just got burned down. How's your shop there?" "The chief is Andy Hudson. Former officer in the parachute regiment. Able chap. But do back up, Edward. What can you tell me, and why is this so important?
He's a walk-in, I guess you'd say. He seems to be a communications guy. He feels real as hell, Nigel. I've requested permission to bust him right out, and Langley has green-lighted it. Pair of fives, man, he added.
So, high priority and high reliability on this chappie.
Foley bobbed his head.
Yep. Want the good news?
If there is any.
He says our comms may be compromised, but your new system hasn't been cracked yet.
Good to hear.
So that means I can communicate freely, but you cannot?
Another nod.
I learned this morning that a communications aid is on its way to me. Perhaps they ginned up a couple of pads for me to use. I'll find out later today, maybe.
Haydock leaned back in his chair and lit up a smoke, a low-tar silk cut. He'd switched to them to make his wife happy.
You have a plan? The Brit spook asked.
I figure he takes the train to Budapest. For the rest of it, well...
Foley outlined the idea he and Mary Pat had figured out.
That is creative, Edward,
Haydock thought.
When did you read up on mincemeat? It's part of the syllabus at our academy, you know.
Back when I was a kid, I always thought it was pretty clever.
In the abstract, not a bad idea. But you know, the pieces you need are not something you pick up at the ironmonger's.
I kind of figured that, Nigel. So if we want to make the play, better that we get moving on it right quick.
Agreed.
Haydock paused.
Basil will want to know a few things. What else can I tell him?
He ought to get a hand-carried letter from Judge Moore this morning. All I can really say is, this guy looks pretty real.
You said he is a communications officer. In the center, is it?
Yep.
That could be very valuable indeed, Haydock agreed. Especially if he's a mail clerk.
He pronounced it Clark. The invocation of the name of Foley's training officer almost caused him to smile, but not quite. It was a slower nod this time, with Foley's eyes locked in on his host.
That's what we're thinking, guy.
It finally got home.
Bloody hell, Haydock breathed. That would be valuable. And he's just a walk-in.
Correct. A little more complicated than that, but that's what it comes down to, bud.
Not a trap. Not a false flag.
I've thought about that, of course, but it just doesn't make any sense, does it? Foley asked. The Brit knew he was agency, but didn't know he was station chief.
If they've ID'd me, why tip their hand this early?
True, Nigel had to agree. That would be clumsy.
So, Budapest, is it?
Easier than out of Moscow.
At least there's that.
There's bad news, too. His wife isn't in on the plan. Foley had to tell him that.
You must be joking, Edward.
Wish I was, man. But that's how it's going down.
Ah. Well, what's life without a few complications?
Any preferences how to get your abbot out? He asked, not quite letting Foley know what he was thinking.
That's for your guy Hudson in Budapest, I suppose. It's not my turf. Not my place to tell him how to run his operation.
Haydock just nodded. It was one of those things that went without saying, but had to be said anyway.
When?
He asked.
Soon. As soon as possible. Langley's almost as hot for this as I am.
And, he didn't add, it was sure as hell a way for him to make an early mark as chief of station Moscow.
Rome, you're thinking?
Sir Basil has been rattling my windows about that.
Your prime minister interested?
About as much as your president, I should imagine.
That play might well muddy the waters rather thoroughly.
Big time, Foley agreed. Anyway, I wanted to give you a heads up. Sir Basil will probably have a signal for you later today.
Understood, Edward.
When that arrives, I'll be able to begin taking action.
He checked his watch.
Too soon to offer his guest a beer in the embassy pub.
Pity.
When you get authorization, give me a call, okay?
Certainly.
We shall get things sorted out for you, Ed. Andy Hudson's a good officer, and he runs a tight operation in Budapest.
Great. Foley stood.
How about a dinner soon? Haydock asked.
I guess we'd better do it soon.
Penny looks about due.
When will you be flying her home?
A couple of weeks. The little bugger is rolling about and kicking all the time now.
Always a good sign, man.
And we have a good physician right here in the embassy, should he be a little early.
Just that the embassy doc didn't really want to deliver a baby.
They never did.
Well, if it's a boy, Eddie will lend you his Transformers tapes, Ed promised.
Transformers? What's that?
If it's a boy, you'll find out, Foley assured him.
Chapter 20. Staging. The junior field officer arrived in London's Heathrow Terminal 4 just before 7 in the morning. He breezed through immigration and customs and headed out, where he saw his driver holding the usual sign card, this one in a false name, of course, since CIA spooks only used their real names when they had to. The driver's name was Leonard Watts. Watts drove an embassy Jaguar, and since he had a diplomatic passport and tags on the car, he wasn't all that concerned with speed limits.
How was the flight?
Fine. Slept most of the way.
Well, welcome to the world of field operations, Watts told him. The more sleep you get, the better.
I suppose.
It was his first overseas assignment, and not a very demanding one.
Here's the package.
And his cover wasn't enhanced by the fact that he was traveling with only the courier package and a small bag that had spent the trip in the overhead bin, with a clean shirt, clean underwear, and shaving kit.
Name's Len, by the way.
Okay, I'm Pete Gatewood.
First time in London.
Yeah, Gatewood answered, trying to get used to sitting in the left front seat without a steering wheel to protect him, and being driven by a NASCAR reject.
How long to get to the embassy?
Half hour.
Watts concentrated on his driving.
What are you carrying?
Something for the COS is all I know.
Well, it isn't routine. They woke me up for it, Watts groused.
Where have you worked? Gatewood asked, hoping to get this maniac to slow down some.
All around. Bonn, Berlin, Prague.
Getting ready to retire back to Indiana.
We got a football team to watch now.
Yeah, and all the corn, too, Gatewood observed.
He'd never been to Indiana and had no particular wish to tour the farming state, which did, he reminded himself, turn out some fairly good basketball players.
Soon enough, or nearly so, they were passing a large green park on the left, and a few blocks after that, the green rectangle of Grosvenor Square. Watts stopped the car to let Gatewood out. He dodged around the flower pots designed to keep car bombers from getting too close to the concrete that surrounded the surpassingly ugly building, and walked it. The Marines inside checked his ID and made a call. Presently, a middle-aged woman came into the entrance foyer and led him to an elevator that took him to the third floor, just next door to the technical group that worked closely with the British GCHQ at Cheltenham. Gatewood walked into the proper corner office and saw a middle-aged man sitting at an oaken desk.
You Gatewood?
Yes, sir.
I'm Randy Silvestri. You have a package for me, the COS London announced.
Yes, sir.
Gatewood opened the zipper on his bag and pulled out the large manila envelope. He handed it over.
"Interested in what's in it?" Silvestri asked, eyeing the youngster. "If it concerns me, I expect you'll tell me, sir." The station chief nodded his approval.
"Very good. Annie will take you downstairs for breakfast if you want, or you can catch a cab for your hotel. Got some Brit money?"
£100, sir, in tens and twenties."
"Okay, that'll handle your needs. Thanks, Gatewood."
"Yes, sir." And Gatewood left the office. Silvestri ripped open the package after determining that the closure hadn't been disturbed beforehand. The flat ring binder had what looked like 40 or 50 printed sheets of paper, all space and a half random letters. So, a one-time cipher pad for Station Moscow, the cover note said. He'd have that courier to Moscow on the noon British Airways flight. And two letters, one for Sir Basil, with hand delivery indicated. He'd have a car drive him to Century House after calling ahead. The other one was for that Ryan kid that Jim Greer liked so much, also for hand delivery via Basil's office. He wondered what was up. It had to be non-trivial for this sort of handling. He picked up his phone and hit speed dial number 5. "This is Basil Charleston."
"Basil, it's Randy. Something just came in for you. Can I bring it over?"
A sound of shuffling papers. Basil would know this was important.
"Say 10 o'clock, Randy."
"Right. See you then."
Silvestri sipped his coffee and estimated the time required. He could sit here for about an hour before heading over. Next, he punched his intercom button.
"Yes, sir."
"Annie, I have a package to be couriered to Moscow. We got a bagman on deck."
"Yes, sir."
"Okay, could you take this down to him?"
"Yes, sir."
CIA secretaries are not paid to be verbose.
"Good. Thanks."
Silvestri hung up.
Jack and Kathy were on the train, passing through Elephant and Castle. And he'd still not learned how the damn place had gotten that name, Jack reminded himself. The weather looked threatening. England wasn't broad enough for a storm system to linger, Ryan thought. Maybe there was just a series of rain clouds coming across the Atlantic. In any case, between yesterday and today, his personal record of fair weather over here seemed to be ending. Too bad.
"Just glasses this week, babe?" he asked his wife, her head buried as usual in a medical journal.
"All week," she confirmed. Then she looked up. "It's not as exciting as surgery, but it's still important, you know."
"Kath, if you do it, it must be important."
"And you can't say what you'll be doing."
"Not until I get to my desk."
"And probably not then either."
Whatever it was, it had doubtless been transmitted via secure printer or fax line overnight. Unless it was something really important and had been sent via courier. The time difference actually made that fairly convenient. The early 747 from Dulles usually got in between 6 and 7 in the morning, and then it was 40 minutes more to his desk. The government could work more efficiently than Federal Express when it wanted to. Another 15 minutes of his Daily Telegraph and her NEJM, and they parted company at Victoria. Kathy perversely took the tube. Ryan opted for a cab. He had hustled past the Palace of Westminster, then hopped across the Thames. Ryan paid the £4.50 and added a healthy tip. 10 seconds later, he was inside.
"Good morning, Sir John," Bert Canderton called in greeting.
"Howdy, Sergeant Major," Ryan said in reply, sliding his pass through the gate, then to the elevator and up to his floor. Simon was already in his seat, going over message traffic. His eyes came up when Jack entered.
"Morning, Jack."
"Hey, Simon. How was the weekend?"
"Didn't get any gardening done. Bloody rain."
"Anything interesting this morning?" He poured himself a cup of coffee. Simon's English breakfast tea wasn't bad for tea, but tea just didn't make it for Jack, at least not in the morning.
They didn't have bear claws here either, and Jack had neglected to get his croissant on the way in.
Not yet, but something's coming in from America.
What is it?
Basil didn't say, but when something comes in by hand on a Monday morning, it's usually interesting.
Must be Soviet-related.
He's told me to stand by for it.
Well, might as well start the week with something interesting.
Ryan sipped his coffee.
It wasn't quite up to what Kathy made, but better than tea.
When's it coming in?
About 10. Your station chief, Silvestri, is driving it over.
Ryan had only met him once.
He'd seemed competent enough, but you expected that of a COS. Even one in a sunset posting.
Nothing new from Moscow?
Just some new rumors about Brezhnev's health. Seems that stopping smoking did him precious little good, Harding said, lighting his pipe.
Nasty old bugger, the Brit analyst added.
What about the stuff from Afghanistan?
Ivan's getting cleverer. Those Mi-24 helicopters seem to be rather effective. Bad news for the Afghans.
How do you think that's going to play out?
Harding shrugged.
It's a question of how many casualties Ivan is willing to take. They have the firepower they need to win, so it's a matter of political will. Unfortunately for the Mujahideen, the leadership in Moscow doesn't trouble itself very much with casualties.
Unless something changes the equation, Ryan thought out loud.
Like what?
Like an effective surface-to-air missile to neutralize their helos?
We have the Stinger.
Never used it myself, but the write-up's pretty good.
But can a mob of illiterate savages use a missile properly?
Harding asked dubiously.
A modern rifle, certainly. Machine gun, sure. But a missile?
The idea is to make a new weapon soldier-proof, Simon.
You know, simple enough that you don't have to think while you're dodging bullets. There's not much time to think then, and you make the steps as short as you can.
Like I said, I've never used that one, but I've played with anti-tank weapons, and they're pretty simple.
Well, your government will have to decide to give them the SAMs, and they haven't yet.
Hard for me to get overly excited about it.
Yes, they are killing Russians, and I reckon that's good. But they are bloody savages.
And they killed a lot of Brits once, Ryan reminded himself, and Brit memories are as long as anyone else's.
There was also the issue of having Stingers fall into Russian hands, which would not make the United States Air Force terribly happy. But that was well above his pay grade. There were some rumbles in Congress about it, though.
Jack settled into a seat, sipped his coffee, and read his message traffic. After that, he'd get back to his real job of analyzing the Soviet economy. That would be like drafting a road map of a plateful of spaghetti.
Silvestri's job in London was not a secret. He'd been in the spook business too long, and while he hadn't been burned per se, the East Bloc had pretty much guessed which government agency he worked for by the end of his stay in Warsaw, where he had run a very tight shop and winkled out a lot of good political intelligence. This was to be his final tour of duty. The same was true of most of his officers, and since he was respected by various Allied services, he'd drawn the London posting, where his main job was interfacing with the British Secret Intelligence Service. So he had an embassy Daimler drive him over across the river. He didn't even need a pass to get through security. Sir Basil himself was waiting for him at the entrance, where hands were cordially shaken before the trip upstairs.
"What's the news, Randy?"
"Well, I have a package for you, and one for that Ryan guy," Silvestri announced.
"Indeed. Should I call him in?"
The London COS had read the cover sheet and knew what was in the packages.
"Sure, Baz, no problem. Harding, too, if you want."
Charleston lifted his phone and made the summons. The two analysts arrived in less than 2 minutes. They had all met at least once. Ryan, in fact, was the least familiar with the other American. Sir Basil pointed them to seats. He'd already ripped his envelope open. Silvestri handed Ryan his own message. For his part, Jack was already thinking, oh, shit. Something unusual was in the offing, and he'd learned not to trust new and different things at CIA.
This is interesting, Charleston observed.
Do I open this now? Ryan asked. Silvestri nodded, so he took out his Swiss Army knife and sliced through the heavy manila paper. His message was only 3 pages, personally signed by Admiral Greer. A rabbit, he saw. He knew the terminology. Somebody wanted a ticket out of Moscow. And CIA was providing it with the help of SIS because Station Budapest was currently out of business.
Tell Arthur that we will be pleased to assist Randy. We will, I assume, get a chance to speak with him before you fly him off to London.
It's only fair, Baz, Silvestri confirmed.
How hard to pull this one off, you suppose?
Out of Budapest, Charleston thought for a moment.
Not all that difficult, I should think. The Hungarians have a rather nasty secret police organization, but the country as a whole is not devoutly Marxist.
Oh, this rabbit says that KGB may have compromised your communications. That is what Langley is excited about.
Damn straight, Basil. If that's a hole, we have to plug it up fast.
This guy's in their Mercury? Jesus Christ, Ryan breathed.
You got that one right, Sonny, Silvestri agreed.
But what the hell am I going into the field for? Jack demanded next. I'm not a field officer.
We need one of ours to keep an eye on things.
I quite understand, Randy, Charleston observed, his head still down in his briefing papers.
And you want someone whom the opposition doesn't know?
So it seems.
But why me?
Ryan persisted.
Jack, Sir Basil soothed, your only job will be to watch what happens.
It's just pro forma.
But what about my cover?
We'll give you a new diplomatic passport, C answered. You will be quite safe.
The Vienna Convention, you know.
But it'll be fake.
They won't know that, dear boy.
What about my accent?
It was painfully obvious that his accent was an American's, not a Brit's.
In Hungary? Silvestri asked with a smile.
Jack, with their bloody language, I seriously doubt they will notice the difference. And in any case, with your new documents, your person is quite inviolable.
Relax, kid. It's better than your little girl's teddy bear.
Trust me on that one, okay? Silvestri assured him.
And you'll have a security officer with you at all times, Charleston added.
Ryan had to sit back and take a breath.
He couldn't allow himself to appear to be a wuss, not in front of these guys and not before Admiral Greer.
Okay. Excuse me. It's just that I've never been in the field before. It's all kind of new to me.
He hoped that was adequate backpedaling.
What exactly will I be doing, and how do I go about it?
We'll fly you into Budapest out of Heathrow. Our chaps will pick you up at the airport and take you to the embassy. You will sit it out there. A couple of days, I expect, and then watch how Andy gets your rabbit out of Redland.
Randy, how long would you expect
to get this moving?
End of the week, maybe a day or two longer, Silvestri thought.
The rabbit will fly or take the train to Budapest, and your man will figure how to get him the hell out of Dodge City.
2 or 3 days for that, Sir Basil estimated.
Mustn't be too quick.
Okay, that keeps me away from home for 4 days.
What's my cover story?
for your wife? Charleston asked. Tell her that you have to go to... Oh, to Bonn, shall we say, on NATO business. Be vague on the time factor, he advised. He was inwardly amused to have to explain this to the innocent American abroad. Okay, Ryan conceded the point. Not like I have a hell of a lot of choice in the matter, is there?
Upon getting back to the embassy, Foley walked to Mike Barnes's office. Barnes was the cultural attaché, the official expert on artsy-fartsy stuff. That was a major assignment in Moscow. The USSR had a fairly rich cultural life. The fact that the best part of it dated back to the Tsars didn't seem to matter to the current regime. Probably, Foley thought, because all great Russians wanted to appear kulturni and superior to Westerners, especially Americans whose culture was far newer and far crasser than the country of Borodin and Rimsky-Korsakov. Barnes was a graduate of the Juilliard School and Cornell, and especially appreciated Russian music.
Hey, Mike, Foley said in greeting.
How's keeping the newsies happy? Barnes asked.
The usual. Hey, I got a question for you.
Shoot.
Mary Pat and I are thinking about traveling some, maybe to Eastern Europe, Prague and like that. Any good music to be heard that way?
The Prague Symphony hasn't opened up yet. But Josef Rocha is in Berlin right now, and then he's going to Budapest.
Who's he?
I don't know the name, Foley said, as his heart nearly leapt out of his chest.
Hungarian native, cousin of Miklos Rocha, Hollywood composer. Ben-Hur and like that.
Musical family, I guess. He's supposed to be excellent.
The Hungarian State Railroad has 4 orchestras, believe it or not, and Josef is going to conduct number 1.
You can go there by train or fly, depends on how much time you have.
Interesting, Foley thought aloud. Fascinating, he thought inside.
You know, the Moscow State Orchestra opens up beginning of next month. They have a new conductor, a guy named Anatoly Shemyov. Haven't heard him yet, but he's supposed to be pretty good. I can get you tickets easy.
Ivan likes to show off to us foreigners, and they really are world class.
Thanks, Mike. I'll think about it.
Later, man.
Foley took his leave, and he smiled all the way back to his office.
Bloody hell, Sir Basil observed, reading over the newest cable from Moscow.
What bloody genius came up with this idea? He asked the air.
Oh, he saw. The American officer, Edward Foley.
How the hell will he make this come about? The director general wondered. He'd been about to leave for lunch at Westminster Palace across the river, and he couldn't break that one off. Well, it would be something to ruminate over with his roast beef and Yorkshire pudding.
Lucky me, Ryan observed back in his office.
Jack, it would be less dangerous than crossing the street, which could be a lively exercise in London.
I can take care of myself, Simon, Ryan reminded his workmate. But if I screw up, somebody else takes the fall.
You'll not be responsible for any of that. You'll just be there to observe.
I don't know Andy Hudson myself, but he has an excellent professional reputation.
Great, Ryan commented. Lunchtime, Simon, and I feel like a beer.
Duke of Clarence, all right.
Isn't that the guy who drowned in a barrel of Malmsey wine?
Worse ways to go, Sir John, Harding observed.
What is Malmsey, anyway?
Strong and sweet. Rather like a Madeira.
It now comes from those islands, in fact.
One more piece of trivia learned, Ryan thought, going to get his coat. In Moscow, Zaitsev checked his personnel file. He'd accrued 12 days of vacation time. He and his family hadn't gotten a time slot at Sochi the previous summer.
The KGB quota had been filled in July and August, and so they had gone without. It was easier to schedule a vacation with a preschool child, as in any other country. You got to run away from town whenever you wished. Svetlana was in state-provided daycare, but missing a few days of blocks and crayons was a lot easier to arrange than a week or two of state primary school, which was frowned upon. Upstairs, Colonel Rozhdestvensky was going over the latest message from Colonel Bubovoy in Sofia, just brought in by courier. So the Bulgarian premier had agreed to Moscow's request with a decent lack of annoying questions. The Bulgars knew their place. The chief of state of a supposedly sovereign nation knew how to take his orders from a field-grade officer of Russia's Committee for State Security, which was just as it should be, the colonel thought. And now Colonel Strokov of the Dyrzhavna Sugarnost would be out picking his shooter, undoubtedly a Turk, and Operation 666 could go forward. He would report this to Chairman Andropov later in the day. Three bodies? Alan Kingshot asked in considerable surprise. He was Sir Basil's most senior field officer, a very experienced operator who'd worked the streets of every major European city, first as a legal officer and later as a headquarters troubleshooter, in his 37 years of service to Queen and country. Some sort of switch, is it? Yes. The chap who suggested it is a fan of mincemeats, I imagine, Basil responded. Operation Mincemeat was a World War II legend. It had been designed to give Germany the impression that the next major Allied operation would not be the planned Operation Husky, the invasion of Sicily, and so it had been decided to suggest to German intelligence that Corsica was the intended invasion target. To do this, the Germans were given the body of a dead alcoholic who'd been transformed after a death of dissipation into a major of the Royal Marines, putatively a planning officer for the fictitious operation to seize Corsica. The body had been dropped in the water off the Spanish coast by the submarine HMS Seraph, from which it had washed to shore, been duly picked up, delivered to the local police, autopsied, and the document case, handcuffed to the cadaver's wrist, handed over to the local Abwehr officer. He'd fired the papers off to Berlin, where they'd had the intended effect, moving several German divisions to an island with no more military significance than the fact that it was Napoleon's birthplace. The story was called The Man Who Never Was, the subject of a book and a movie, and further proof of the wretched performance of German intelligence, which couldn't tell the difference between the body of a dead drunk and that of a professional soldier. What else do we know? I mean, Kingshot pointed out, what age and gender, sir? Yes, and hair color and so forth. The manner of death will also be important. We do not know those things yet. So the initial question is a broad one. Is it possible to do this? In the abstract, yes. But before we can go forward with it, I shall need a lot of specifics. As I said, height, weight, hair and eye color, gender, to be sure. With that, we can go forward. Well, Alan, get thinking about it. Get me a specific list of what you need by tomorrow noon. What city will this be in? Budapest, probably. Well, that's something, the field spook thought aloud. Damned grisly business, Sir Basil muttered after his man left. Andy Hudson was sitting in his office, relaxing after his plowman's lunch in the embassy's pub, along with a pint of John Courage beer. Not a tall man, he had 82 parachute jumps under his belt, and had the bad knees to prove it. He'd been invalided out of active service 8 years before, but because he liked a little excitement in his life, he'd opted to join the Secret Intelligence Service, and worked his way rapidly up the ladder, mainly on the strength of his superior language skills. Here in Budapest, he needed those. The Hungarian language is known as Indo-Altaic to philologists. Its nearest European neighbor is Finnish, and after that, Mongolian. It has no relationship at all with any European language, except for some Christian names, which were conveyed when the Magyar people succumbed to Christianity, after killing off enough missionaries to become bored with doing so. Along the way, they'd also lost whatever warrior ethos they'd once had. The Hungarians were about the most unwarlike people on the continent. But they were pretty good at intrigue, and like any society, they had a criminal element. But theirs had mainly gone into the Communist Party and power apparat. The secret police here, the Ajavidelmi Hatoság, could be as nasty as the Cheka had been under Iron Felix himself. But nasty wasn't quite the same as efficient. It was as though they tried to make up for their inbred inefficiency by viciousness against those whom they blundered into catching. And their police were notoriously stupid. There was a Hungarian aphorism, as stupid as six pairs of policemen's boots, which Hudson had largely found to be true. They weren't the Metropolitan Police, but Budapest wasn't London either. In fact, he found life pleasant here. Budapest was a surprisingly pretty city, very French in its architecture, and surprisingly casual for a communist capital. The food was remarkably good, even in the government-run worker canteens that dotted every street corner, where the fare was not elegant, but tasty. Public transportation was adequate to his purposes, which were mainly political intelligence. He had a source, called Parade, inside the Foreign Ministry, who fed him very useful information about the Warsaw Pact and East Bloc politics in general, in return for cash, and not very much cash at that, so low were his expectations. Like the rest of Central Europe, Budapest was an hour ahead of London. The embassy messenger knocked on Hudson's door, then reached in to toss an envelope onto his desk. Hudson set down his small cigar and lifted it. From London, he saw. Sir Basil himself. Bloody hell, Hudson thought. His life was about to get a little bit more interesting. More details to follow, it ended. About right. You never knew it all until you had to do it. Sir Basil wasn't a bad chap to work for, but like most spymasters, he greatly enjoyed being clever, which was something never fully appreciated out in the field, where the worker bees had wasps to worry about. Hudson had a staff of three, including himself. Budapest wasn't a major station, and for him it was a way station until something more important opened up. As it was, he was young to be a station chief. Basil was giving him the chance to stretch his legs. That suited Hudson. Most station chiefs sat in their offices like spiders in their webs, which looked dramatic but could actually be quite boring, since it involved writing endless reports. He ran field tasks himself. That ran the risk of his being burned, as Jim Zell had been. Bloody awful luck. Nothing more than that, Hudson had learned from a source named Boot, who was right inside the AVH. But in the danger came the charm of the job. It was less dangerous than jumping out the back of a Lockheed Hercules with 60 pounds of weapons and rations strapped to your back. Also less dangerous than patrolling Belfast with provos about. But it was the skills learned in the city streets of Ulster that gave him his street smarts as a spook. As with everything else in life, you took the bitter with the sweet. But better, he told himself, to take his bitter by the pint. He had a rabbit coming out. That ought not to be difficult, though this rabbit had to be an important one, so much so that CIA was asking for assistance from six, and that didn't happen every day. Only when the bloody Yanks buggered things up, which was, Hudson thought, not too infrequent. There was nothing for him to do as yet. He could not know what needed to be done until he had a lot more specifics. but in the abstract, he knew how to get people out of Hungary. It wasn't all that hard. The Hungarians were insufficiently wedded to Marxism to be that serious an adversary. So he sent off a message-received dispatch to Century House and awaited further developments.